calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Welcome back from the holiday season, or it's the Christmas holiday, the first day of Hanukkah yesterday, Christmas yesterday, today the second day of Hanukkah, the first day of Kwanzaa. And there's a Hindu holiday in there somewhere I'm forgetting. Diwali, I believe it is. The Festival of Lights. It's also a solstice. And what are we, a week now after the pagan Yule holiday? So welcome back, whatever it may be for you. Hope you're having a happy holiday season. And, of course, New Year's down the road coming up. Tom Hartman here with you live, broadcasting on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, streaming on AirAmericaRadio.com, WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, just all over the planet. Welcome back to our program. Our quote for the day from Sir James Goldsmith. When he died, he was the second richest man in the world, perhaps a third British billionaire. And he wrote a marvelous book, by the way, called The Trap. I did a book review of it over at BuzzFlash.com. Go over to BuzzFlash.com and click on book reviews. And in fact, they're still offering it, even though it's out of print now. They found a bunch of used copies. It's an amazing book about the economy and economics. And so our quote for the day from Sir James Goldsmith, British billionaire, "The economy is a tool to serve us. It is not a demigod to be served by society." Our guest to begin this hour, Alex Epstein, he's with Ayn Rand, the Ayn Rand Institute, a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, holds a BA in philosophy from Duke University. Hey, Alex, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on here. Alex, I think it's important that voices like yours, I mean, Ayn Rand with her book Atlas Shrugged really was probably one of the foundational thinkers of certainly what created objectivism, what you guys are into, which then in some ways morphed into libertarianism and then in some ways morphed into the modern conservative and neoconservative movement, although I realize that you would disavow yourself from them. They're would you say, not radical enough for you?
Well, I wouldn't put it in those terms, but we would certainly disavow both of those. The conservatives, because they don't truly support capitalism, they support religion, and they support various forms of self-sacrifice to the so-called common good, which is incompatible with capitalism. And then libertarianism, because they reject the whole realm of morality. They try to defend liberty, but they have no real moral foundation, and they have no real definition of liberty. So it ends up that they'll support really disastrous causes or really...
But at a certain level, isn't it really that, you know, like Harry Truman back in the mid-40s, late-40s, actually, Harry Truman said, you know, every 4 years, the Republicans get religion and start talking like Democrats for a year before the election, and then they go back to trying to, you know, enrich the rich and help out the corporations. But, you know, there's that 1 year where the Republicans are talking about things that, you know, they like Social Security all of a sudden, and they, you know, the social programs like that. Isn't that really what you're talking about?
No, not at all. That's not what I'm talking about. I mean, the Republicans, insofar as they allow freedom, and that benefits everyone, including the rich, that's fine and that's legitimate. Unfortunately, that's not what they're in favor of, and you mentioned them enriching the rich. I mean, the only way in which that's illegitimate is if they do it by various coercive government favors.
Well, speaking of government favors, let's get right to the topic of the day. You seem to think that Enron is a badly misunderstood company.
In the sense that, first of all, it was a really immoral company, and it did certainly commit fraud, and it did certainly exploit a lot of people. But it's the primary way in which it's bad is, I think, misunderstood. So there's an interesting lesson. Enron is usually thought of as this company whose leaders were so eager to make money that they hatched this fraudulent scheme to bilk everybody. And that's not really true. The fraud that they did hatch fraud, or at least a couple of them did, but it was to cover up some just an incredible string of disastrous business decisions. And the reason that they made these disastrous business decisions was not because they were so concerned about making money, but because they didn't really have a respect for what making money required. They acted in a very short-range way, acting on their whims, wanting to think that they were the greatest geniuses ever, but in fact they weren't. And as they made bad decisions and those led to bad results instead of facing.
Well, these are all very much generalities, Alex. Let's look at some specifics. Here are some.
Okay.
These are tape recordings that were made right here in Portland, Oregon, where I'm broadcasting live from today, and made at the Enron headquarters and later released in court proceedings. And I'll provide the context. And here we go. Here's the first one.
Burn, baby, burn. That's a beautiful thing.
Okay, so now when he says burn, baby, burn, that's a beautiful thing. What he was talking about was the fires in California that were bringing down power lines that were thus jacking up power prices in California. I assume that since that's part of the supply and demand thing, I mean, you know, if the lines are going down, the prices are going up, and that's helping Enron, that's just fine with you, right?
Well, that is a really perverse thing, and I don't even know who that is at Enron. But the issue with the electricity market in California and the reason that there were all of these people had jacked up power prices is because it was not a free market at all. And so instead of people being able to lock in long-term contracts and to have real competition, it's this totally government-regulated thing where some unscrupulous person can find loopholes in the so-called.
But how can you have competition in power when there's only one set of power lines?
Well, there are various ways. I don't know. It's not a free market, unfortunately, so it's hard to predict.
It's impossible for it to be a free market because you have a natural monopoly.
No.
Power is a natural. When you have centralized power systems, you have one main set of lines that are carrying the electricity, and if you decide that one company is going to own them, it's, I mean, what? Who are they going to compete with?
What do you mean you have one set of lines? Nature did not create one set of power lines. There were no power lines, so somebody constructed power lines. It's possible that one person could construct them and then lease them out to various people. It's possible that people could construct alternative systems. They could construct various kinds of generators. There's no reason in the world why there can be only one source of power. I assume you're in favor of things like solar power. You can have generators closer to home. There's no such thing as a natural monopoly in which one person somehow can force everyone out of a market.
Well, that monopoly is there. I mean, the reality is that if a company wants, if I want to buy electricity right here in Portland, Oregon, I've got to buy it from Enron. Period. That's my only choice.
Well, I don't know. Does Enron serve you?
Yeah. They own Portland General Electric.
Okay. Well, that's a government.
Right this minute.
That's a coercive monopoly created by the government, which I'm certainly against. That's an anti-capitalist phenomenon where they make the market, where they forbid everyone except one person from entering the market, and that can lead to coercive exploitation.
Okay, here's now arbitrage, making money with money. Here's some comments, some local guys talking, you know, Enron guys again, talking about Ken Lay.
California. He steals money from California to the tune of about a million.
Can you rephrase that?
Okay, he arbitrages the California market to the tune of $1 million a day.
Now, arbitrage, you know, defining the price because you can control the market. I mean, it's, again, this is the free enterprise system at work. You got no problem with that, right?
The Enron has nothing, in terms of the California electricity market, to call that the free market system is a joke because none of the electricity market is free, and especially not the convoluted system in California. I don't exactly know what you mean by arbitrage in this case, since that usually applies to foreign currency markets, and then there's a legitimate value there.
Well, they were using that phrase to describe the manipulation of energy markets.
Well, if they're finding some way to just get money without creating any value, that is in a free market.
Oh no, they're providing the value of electricity. Here's some more from these
guys.
If
you took down a steamer, how long would it take to get it back up?
Oh, it's not something you want to just be turning on and off every hour.
Yeah. That way. Well, why don't you just go ahead and shut her down?
That's Enron ordering the shutdown of a power plant specifically to create a blackout or a brownout in California, specifically to lead to the increase in the price of electricity in California of several 100%. This was right after meetings between Ken Lay, secret meetings between Ken Lay and Arnold Schwarzenegger, way back when. This is what happens when you have absolutely unrestrained capitalism. You know, when the electricity markets were totally deregulated under the pressure of Ken Lay, by the way.
That is just a fiction. They were not totally unregulated at all. They were completely regulated. There were no, in a free market, it's possible to negotiate long-term power contracts where the electricity provider has to provide you the electricity at a given point instead of renegotiating.
But if they have to, you're talking about using the coercive power of government.
No, they have to by contract. Contract is
Who enforces the contract?
It's enforced by the government, but
So we're back to government. I thought you didn't want government involved in the marketplace.
That's not true. I said the government is involved in the marketplace only insofar as it's necessary to prevent force and fraud, and that includes to enforce voluntary arrangements that people have made. There's a difference between that and the government entering in the market coercively and seizing people's money or preventing them from entering a certain business, which is the kind of regulation that occurs in California. That's a life and death difference.
Okay. Alex Epstein, you're an articulate spokesman for your cause, and I appreciate your coming on the program. The website, Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. Alex, happy holidays to you. Have a great new year.
All right, happy holidays. Thanks.
Bye now. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Forces of the world unite, let us save the day. Malcontents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay. We only make 500 times as much as our average worker drone.
Oh, ain't life rough?
We work just as hard, and we too sometimes need to paint our homes.
You gotta feel for these bosses.
The pressures are incredible, and no one seems to care. We moved our plants to Haiti, and now we have to move from there. They're clamoring for more than $1 a day from Malaysia to Mexico. At that rate, pretty soon there'll be no place for us to go.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. 1-866-440-8466, toll-free coast-to-coast. We are live. It's the Monday after the holidays here, which would make it, what, the 26th? Yeah, Monday, December 26th, 2005. And talking about the real live results of, on the one hand, absolutely unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism. On the other hand, rigged energy markets, which you could say are in some ways, you know, contradictory to each other. Continuing with our clips from Enron.
And taking all the money back from you guys. All the money you guys stole from those poor grandmothers of California.
Yeah, Grandma Millie, man.
Yeah, now she wants her f***ing money back for the power you charged right up, jammed right up.
Yeah, okay, well, we'll stop it at that point, but you get the point. And these are guys at Enron going, yeah, we've got this thing figured out. We're under control. Well, it's still here, my friends. The Wall Street Journal reported just last week, and I quote, an Alaska state authority charged that British Petroleum PLC and Exxon Mobil Corp., the world's two largest publicly traded oil companies, are conspiring to withhold natural gas from U.S. markets and reinforce their market power over North Slope supplies. The Alaska Gasoline Port Authority said who brought the lawsuit, said that British Petroleum's refusal, or BP's refusal, to agree to ship its natural gas and ExxonMobil's failure to develop its huge fields amounts to warehousing, in quotes, a desperately needed resource in an effort to drive up prices. That from the Wall Street Journal. This the day later from the Los Angeles Times, December 21st. Electricity rates for more than two-thirds of Southern California's Edison customers will rise as much as 18% in the new year. The company said Tuesday. The utility said the first increase to take effect January 1st would stem in part from higher natural gas prices. Natural gas prices, the key force between two of the three Edison rate increases, are expected to push up electricity and heating bills across the state. And so, you know, here we are, the wonders of Enron, the wonders of the absolute, unrestrained, free market economy. And I'm telling you, people around the world are starting to say, enough of this already. Enough of this already. We really don't. Again, to quote Sir James Goldsmith, the economy is a tool to serve us. It is not a demigod to be served by society. And, you know, increasingly people are waking up to that. 1-866-440-8466. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense in the radical middle. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Let's keep it real simple.
Sure.
when free market companies buy up their competition, they become free monopolies. There's a distinct difference in effect on society between a free market and a free monopoly.
You're absolutely right. And the only thing that prevents the two, Armin, as you well know, is government intervention. That's why old Senator Sherman from Ohio back in 1880 introduced the Senate Bill No. 1, the Sherman Antitrust Act, to prevent big companies from getting bigger by eating all the small and medium-sized companies and ending up monopolies. It's the Walmart problem. It's the McDonald's problem. It is the Enron problem.
Exactly. And when the cable communications bill went through in 96, remember that liar,
oh, yeah,
Ken Rich, that was balking his girlfriend when he was criticizing Clinton? He says, oh, let us pass this. Cable will be never be cheaper. Hello, everybody. Who's
yeah.
got cheaper cable since 1996?
There you go. And that's the exactly right, Armin. You said it very well. Oop, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were going to continue. Susan in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Susan, welcome to the program. 1-866-440-8466, our number. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How are you today? And thanks for listening on KPTK.
Great. I love your program. I just wanted to thank you for having the people from the Ayn Rand Institute on so often,
mm-hmm.
because at least I don't agree with them, but at least they can articulate their viewpoint without all the shouting and character assassination and the nastiness.
Well, the thing that I appreciate about them is that they tell the truth. I get guys from the Republican Party on here and say, you know, why do you want to privatize Medicare and or Social Security? And instead of saying, well, because we believe that people should simply be left on their own. I mean, you know, that's what the Ayn Rand folks would say. They say, oh, well, you know, it'll be the best thing for everybody. And they just don't, you know, they just won't tell the truth. Cons don't tell the truth. And the Ayn Rand people, who are in many ways the philosophical foundation of today's cons, Alan Greenspan, initiated by Ayn Rand in her apartment in the 1950s or 60s in New York into this group, you know, lays it out pretty straightforward. Susan, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. Yeah,
and you
say it well. And you know, Alan Greenspan coming right out in 1998 and saying that part of his job as chairman of the Fed is to maintain a certain level of worker insecurity in the workplace. All right. 866-440-8466, our number, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
What a crock! The 2000 election. And welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where reason and passion go together like Republican presidents and gay hookers. Hey, you want to drop into our live chat room? By the way, Quantum Spin in the chat room says, Tom, given Enron, how could we ever allow those same folks to run Social Security or even our health care system? Yeah, good question. Well, that's what we've done. We've privatized our health care system. Have you ever tried to talk to a bureaucrat with your health insurance company and challenge something? Have you ever said, you know, I would like to have my message communicated to the president of this health insurance company? Can't happen. You can communicate your message to your member of Congress, to your senator, but to the president of your health care company, forget it. Anyhow, you want to drop into our live chat room, just drop by, go to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, it'll get you there. It is T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's, but I think all four various misspellings we have, so just type in tomhartman.com and click live chat. And you can drop in and participate with real people in real time here today. Former Enron Chairman Ken Lay testifying before Congress. He says, I come here today with a profound sadness about what has happened to Enron and its current and former employees, retirees, shareholders, and other stakeholders. As Daniel Kurtzman notes, what he really meant, I come here today with a profound sadness about what has happened to three of my four properties in Aspen, my jet, my baseball stadium, and my all-access pass to the White House. Yeah. Mr. Lay, what he said. Mr. Lay, I've concluded you're perhaps the most accomplished confidence man since Charles Ponzi. This is Senator Peter Fitzgerald of Illinois. I'd say you're a carnival barker, except that wouldn't be fair to carnival barkers. A carny will at least tell you up front he's running a show game. What he really meant... How come I only got a measly $18,000 in campaign contributions when you were giving other senators double and triple that? So this is the problem. I mean, you know, we have a broken system. It's not just that Enron, Ken Lay came up with this idea for hustle and money and sold it to the Bushy White House and actually sold it to Clinton. I mean, you know, sold it into the Clinton administration, this whole idea of deregulation, sold it to Bush Sr. and then Clinton, and they deregulated the energy markets, and here comes Enron, and they're cooking along, and it's a phony thing. It's a phony thing. And now we've got, you know, weird situations like in Iraq, where the $87 billion that John Kerry voted for before he voted against it had a provision that said that If a corporation is going to participate in reconstruction of Iraq, it has to be an American corporation that actually pays taxes on that money that they got from the U.S. taxpayers. And so Halliburton reincorporates a division, Kellogg, Brown & Root, in the Cayman Islands, as I recall. And it might have been the Bahamas or Bermuda or something, but anyhow, they reincorporate that division. And so they don't have to pay U.S. taxes. And guess who's getting all the contracts? And had a lot of members of Congress pretty outraged. 1-866-440-8466, a telephone number. Josh in Long Island, New York. Hey, Josh, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I'm sure you've talked about this before. I just finished reading Jim Hightower's book, If God Had Wanted Us to Vote, They'd Have Given Us Candidates.
Right.
And I didn't realize just how much contempt us progressives should have for the Democrats over NAFTA, among other things. But they read that book, and it came out 4 years ago, and I know it's a big seller, and he's a popular guy. How do any Democrats still stand up for these people?
Well, here's the problem, Josh, and one of the big things that's going on right now is there is a battle within the Democratic Party for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. It's one of the reasons why I encourage progressives to, even if they are members of the Green Party or, for example, in Vermont, the Progressive Party, to also get involved with the Democratic Party, because we do, by and large, have a two-party system in the United States. And if progressives, if people who really understand what's going on, people who have a good understanding of the history of this country, can get involved in politics inside the Democratic Party, then perhaps we could take it back. But there is this faction within the Democratic Party, the Democratic Leadership Council faction, the DLC faction, that brought us NAFTA, that brought us WTO and GATT, you know, the GATT that led to WTO, that brought us CAFTA. And
I think you're doing everyone a disservice if you just put it in a broad term like that instead of just saying Clinton and Kerry and whichever Democrats were in office when that happened. Anyone who didn't stand up and filibuster this thing is guilty in my book. You just have Kucinich, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm not willing to go that far. I'm sorry. You know, the first of all, Kucinich couldn't have filibustered because he was in the House of Representatives, and you can
right,
only filibuster
right.
in the Senate, number one. And number two, you can't do that. You can't go against the leadership of your own party. That's the problem.
You wouldn't have done it? You wouldn't have filibustered?
No, here's the point. You wouldn't have the option. You wouldn't have the opportunity because the leader of the party, if that leader of the party is the Speaker of the House, they get to determine the agenda, and the leader of the party gets to determine the agenda by and large. The biggest, for example, here in Oregon, where I live right now, and when I lived in Vermont, I just moved here in April. The 10 years I lived in Vermont before that, we had Jim Jeffords in Vermont, was a Republican, a good guy. In fact, the only Republican I've ever voted for. And here we've got Gordon Smith, who I will never vote for. And Gordon Smith portrays himself as a moderate. And a lot of people in Oregon go, oh, that's cool. He's kind of a moderate guy. Okay, well, vote for him. But the reality is that the first vote that a member of Congress, whether it's the Senate or the House, casts is really the most important vote of their entire 2 years or 6 years, whether it's a House member or a Senate member, and that is the vote for leadership. And we have, you know, this extreme right-wing leadership now that's taken over the Republican Party and the leadership of the Democratic Party. I'm really impressed that Howard Dean's the head of the DNC, Democratic National Committee. But, I think that we need to be supporting the Democrats in the party who are the progressives, the Russ Feingolds, the Barbara Boxers, the Dennis Kucinichs, those Democrats who are willing to step up and speak out, and we need to support them in every way we possibly can, and participate. Josh, have you shown up at any Democratic Party functions?
Not lately. I've done a few things during primaries.
See, that's the thing. I mean, you ask most people that question, and I don't mean to pick on you personally, but, that's the answer. No, I don't have time to do it. And this is where it's really important that we get out there and we get involved. And so, Josh, thanks a lot for the call. It's a good point that you make, but I tell you, it's this is very much not a blame the victim thing, but it's up to us. It's up to us, we the individuals. We have to get out there. We have to participate. We have to be the ones who are getting involved in this thing. It's just, and it's kind of the reverse, for example, dealing with Walmart. People call about Walmart and they say, if only everybody stopped shopping at Walmart, or how dare you drive a car that was made in some other country or whatever, that kind of thing. In that regard, when it comes to those kinds of things, I'm sorry, I won't blame people who walk into Walmart. I won't do it myself, but I'm not going to blame somebody who does. I'm not going to blame somebody who owns a foreign car. I don't know if it was made here or not, but it's a Toyota, which is the second largest automaker in the United States right now, may soon be the largest. So, we'll see. But in any case, the point is, I'm not going to blame people for that, because shaming consumers is not a national industrial policy. What we need are politicians who are aware of these issues, who will say, hey, wait a minute, we need to change. We need to change the insane policies that we have been following that have led us to these positions. And the only way that we're going to get those kinds of politicians is if we have an informed electorate. I mean, we're back to Thomas Jefferson here, that without an informed electorate, you're not going to have a functional democracy. It's that simple, which is one of the reasons, in my opinion, why the conservatives work so hard to make sure that our electorate is confused. Is lost. I mean, just is gone. And one of the reasons why so many so-called news programs are just infotainment, because, then it's a whole lot easier to keep people in the dark. You have the conservative agenda can be boiled down to two words, as conceptualguerrilla.com points out so brilliantly, cheap labor. I mean, you can really boil the entire conservative agenda down to just those two words, cheap labor. And I would add two words to that, corporate personhood, corporations claiming that they have the rights of human beings and therefore the powers of human beings. But around the world, people are starting to say, hey, wait a minute. We would like to have, some say in something that's going on here. The weird thing is, there's an apocryphal quote that's going around. And every year, this thing surfaces, and I get it from the right-wingers who email to me, and I get it from the left-wingers who email to it, and pretty much from everybody. It's a quote from an old Scottish economist from the 19th century saying, democracies never last, or from the 18th century, the 1800s. Saying democracies never last, they always self-destruct, there's never been a democracy that didn't self-destruct, because eventually the people will vote for them, if the people are given the power, they will vote for themselves all the welfare and no taxes, and it'll destroy the country. Well, in point of fact, first of all, it's an apocryphal quote. It's not a real quote, number one. Number two, because at the time he said that, there had never been a democracy that had lasted long enough to do such a thing. He said, after 200 or 300 years. And that's not what brought down Greece, by the way. It definitely is not, Alexander the Great, probably more than anything else, is, and Aristotle is what brought down Greece, or Aristotle's, opposition to democracy. But the reality is that people want a balance in their democracy between free enterprise, the ability to start a business and to get out there and make some money. They want a balance between that, on the one hand, and the oligarchic power, the king-like power of huge, massive corporations. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way to New Orleans.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Welcome back to the program. 1-866-440-8466. Toll free across the United States. Our telephone number, Alan in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT.
Yes,
hey, Alan, what's up?
Honor and a privilege to talk to you. I'd like to elaborate like on the NAFTA issue.
Sure.
You make a lot of very important issues that you say are very truthful. I work in an electronics facility in Pittsburgh, and we're going to be a byproduct of NAFTA very shortly here. And, you know, you're right. A lot of people are unaware of what's going on in the world today. They're distracted with a lot of things that are going on. And you're right. You need citizen groups. People need to get out there and make things aware, like yourself, of what's really going on in the real world from real people. And your biased media is not going to give anybody that type of information. And until we get politicians that are actually going to go in there that aren't Council on Foreign Relations members or vice versa, that are actually going to get in there and represent the people, foreign policy and things aren't going to be a change what's actually going on today.
Yeah, broadly, I don't disagree, Alan, although I don't see this as as so much as a like Council on Foreign Relations kind of conspiracy thing as one of true believers of ideology. I think Bill Clinton got swept up in this too. It's the same thing that happened with Reagan with supply side economics, which we can discuss in another context another time. But to talk about international trade, from the time this country started in 1787, I mean, that was the year that the Constitution was put forward, 2 years before it was actually ratified. We were still operating under the Articles of Confederation. In 1787, we passed the first law, the first, quote, tariff that included, it was pushed by a guy named Tench Cox, who was never elected anything. He was the founder of the first Chamber of Commerce in the United States. He was a small businessman who initially opposed separating from England because he thought it would be bad for business. Then he got on board, and then he became good friends with Franklin and Madison and a bunch of the others, you know, and he pushed through this legislation that specifically said tariffs for the protection of domestic industries. And what people don't get is how tariffs work, and tariffs, and ultimately tariffs funded 100% of our government right up until the Civil War. All of the government revenue, the federal government, was paid for with tariffs. And from the Civil War until World War One, it started out about 80%, and by World War One we were down to around 40%, but still, just, you know, roughly half of government was paid for with tariffs. And the whole point of a tariff is to say, okay, if in the United States I want to make a pair of shoes, and that pair of shoes is going to have a dollar's worth of labor in it to make that pair of shoes. If somebody wants to make that pair of shoes in Malaysia, it'll only cost 10 cents worth of labor. So if that's fine, they can make the shoes in Malaysia, but we're going to slap a 90-cent import tax onto those shoes when they come into this country. So wherever you make them, you're going to have to pay a dollar for that tax, for that labor. You know, whether you're paying it to the actual laborer or whether you're paying 10 cents to the laborer in Malaysia and 90 cents to the government, doesn't matter. And that's how we kept shoe factories in the United States for 200 years.
You can't do business with people who don't have money. They're not a purchasing nation.
You're right.
Our sovereignty.
You're right. Exactly. What we're doing
and
is we're going to
administration. They're raping the people. They're going to take the shirt off of your back if somebody doesn't get in there and really has the guts to get in there and turn things around.
Yeah.
I mean, I listen to your show. I listen to Bernie Sanders, and there's a lot of things I love that I listen to. I got my cable shut off after listening to you.
Oh, really? How's that?
That's how informative your show is, and I encourage a lot of people that I work with, I tell them about you, to listen to you and that, and you're dead on it. You don't seem biased. You seem very educated on a lot of the matters that you talk about.
Well, thank you, Alan.
And people are hurting out there. We really need something to be done. I mean, there's elderly people that are freezing in homes that can't even pay their heating bills, and you got this administration now talking about they want to privatize, not to beat a dead horse, they want to privatize Social Security. You've got Slick Rick Santorum saying he saved it. This guy's done nothing for the Commonwealth.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you, Alan. You said it very well, and thank you for your kind words, and it's great to hear from you. The point is that when Bill Clinton came along, and it wasn't just Clinton, but, you know, it really started with Reagan. Reagan, Bush Sr., and then Clinton, all three of them were all gung-ho in favor of this free trade thing. And like I said, I really don't see this as some sort of horrible conspiracy on the part of like UN, multilateralist, trilateral, CFR. If you want a group of conspirators, It's the multinational corporations. It's the conference board, the CEOs of the 100 largest corporations in America, which Jon Snow, our current Treasury Secretary, used to be the president of, by the way. I mean, that's the group that was pushing really hard for NAFTA, CAFTA, and the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, GATT, which created the WTO, the World Trade Organization. And basically what these were treaties that surrendered the sovereignty of the United States to multinational corporations, let them write the rules, and they said, do away with these tariffs that are protecting American workers, that are protecting American jobs, throw these tariffs to the wind, screw the American workers, let multinational corporations bring in stuff as cheap as they want, and all of a sudden Sam Walton's, hey, made in USA. Remember back in the 70s, Sam Walton, is, you know, Walmart, made in the USA, his whole campaign, poof, it's gone. I mean, it went when Clinton signed NAFTA and GATT. And we need to wake people up to that. And the one great thing that George W. Bush taught us, when he first came into office, I mean, this is one of the great lessons that George W. Bush taught us, is we don't need those stinking treaties, right? I mean, he walked away from Kyoto. He walked away from the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which had kept us, you know, and the world relatively secure for four decades in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, stopped the arms race. He said, I don't want that stuff. I'm just going to walk away. I'll build any old nuclear missiles I want. We don't need no stinking treaty. Well, we don't need no stinking treaties when it comes to these trade agreements, and we can walk away from them. I mean, we literally can walk away from them. And frankly, I think that that's what we need to be doing. We need to be saying, enough already. You know, we're just not going to do it. We're not going to go there. And we need to go back to a tariff system that built this country, that made us the most powerful industrial force in the history of the world. And if we don't do that, we are going to continue down the road to becoming a third world nation. And you know, the working class, the middle class of America is going to continue to become the working poor of America, and we're going to go back to the world that Charles Dickens so brilliantly chronicled in so many of his books, including, for this season of the year, The Christmas Carol. Hey, Mr. Scrooge, may I have a lump of coal, please?
No, you may not.
How about health care for Tiny Jim?
No, I've got to have profits.
57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live on radio stations all across the United States on Sirius Satellite Radio. Streaming from AirAmericaRadio.com. RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital on cable systems in 29 states. Welcome back to our program. Sometimes you think you know everything that you need to know. Sometimes you think that you know there's things that you don't need to know, that you don't know. Obviously, there's things that we know that we don't need to know. Sometimes there are things that you know that you don't know that you need to know, and sometimes you don't know what you know that you need to know, and then you don't know that you don't know what you need to know. And that's the real problem, is when you don't know what you don't know that you need to know, because you need to know it, but you don't know that you don't know it because you don't know that you need to know it yet, because if you knew it, then you would know, right? Yeah.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Yeah, every now and then we want to, on this program, stretch our minds a little bit, go beyond just kind of the normal rant about politics, although I promise you we will get back to that very shortly. And in fact, in a way, this is really in the context of it. Are we trying to produce in the United States with our public education system, particularly with the conservative insanity of the way that they screwed up the No Child Left Behind Act, are we trying to produce, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same, nice little kids who are just the standard issue. George Lynn is a licensed mental health counselor for Bellevue, Washington, has pioneered the use of psychotherapy for adults and children with neuropsychological disorders and issues. He's lectured internationally on the subject, authored three popular books on parenting children, Survival Strategies for Parenting Your ADD Child, Survival Strategies for Parenting a Child with Bipolar Disorder, and his most recent book, which is what I'd like to speak with him about, Genius, Nurturing the Spirit of the Wild, Odd, and Oppositional Child. And I got to say, also, I should toss in, George is an old friend of mine and just one of the most brilliant people that I've ever met in my whole entire life. George, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
so glad to have you here. George, how is it that wild, odd, and oppositional children are being not just labeled and not just shunted aside in our society, but vilified?
Well, I think what's going on is it's an economic thing in a certain way. There's a great drive, you know, to standardize everybody. You were talking before about, you know, standardized tests, standardized kids. And the kids that I work with, those who are diagnosed with, you know, ADD, bipolar disorder, Asperger's disorder, things like that, are not standardized.
Correct.
And so what happens is they, you know, people pick them apart, pick a symptom here and there and say, well, we're going to medicate this. We're going to make you almost as good as new, even though you're broken. And I would say that my book is about is, you know, my adventures talking with these kids and finding out that if you really listen, if you really take the time to let some rapport develop, and if you sort of listen past all the symptoms and all the disturbing behaviors, you start getting an idea who that kid is that's, you know, sitting across from you. And you start getting to the place where you can fashion a story for them or help them fashion a story in which they don't see themselves as broken or a victim, but start seeing themselves as like, okay, these are my challenges. This is what I'm dealing with. This is what I've got to do. And they start feeling more like the origin of their own lives.
I remember when one of our kids was diagnosed with ADHD, the thing that I think was most devastating was it was a psychologist in this case, educational testing specialist, saying, you have a brain disease. This is ultimately why I wrote 7 books on attention deficit disorder that I think philosophically are very much in alignment, by and large, with your books, George, is that just that notion that there are some of us who are broken rather than simply there are some of us who are different, I think is a very, very toxic notion.
Yes. Well, it's when you look at it, too, I mean,
it's a broken notion.
It's a broken notion. When I start with this book, I have the fairy tale from Grimm's Brothers, okay, the genie in the bottle. You know, the boy, you know, rubs the bottle, the genie comes out, and the boy talks the genie into going back into the bottle and then works a deal with him. And a lot of the kids that I work with are like, in that sense, the genie in the bottle. They need a lot of containment. They've got a lot of talent, a lot of energy. But there's a developmental lag. So you can say not broken, but somewhat delayed developmentally. So they need a certain, you know, environment, certain set of principles, you know, parenting strategies to help them grow into their gifts and you know, not be destructive to themselves or other people when they're little kids.
Yeah, and this is what's so useful about your new book, Nurturing the Spirit of the Wild, Oppositional and Wild, Odd, and Oppositional Child. Actually, Genius is the title. I just gave the subtitle. Your 7 points for nurturing positive genius. I'm wondering about historic personalities who are wild, odd, or oppositional children. Any
well,
names
sure.
come to mind?
It's really hard to find.
Other than you and me, George.
Thanks, Sam. Yeah. Well, off the beaten path here, it's really hard to find anybody in history. And, you know, it's kind of a challenge to find somebody in history who hasn't made a big change in the way things are, who wasn't, you know, who wouldn't have been medicated as a kid. You know, take Nikola Tesla, you know, the great inventor, Edison's contemporary.
Sure.
He most likely was, or he was just straight across nutty at times, probably autistic. A great visionary, you know, as you know, invented AC power.
Yep.
You got people like Edison himself. Some people have said he's ADD. Other people said, well, there are features of, you know,
Asperger's.
Yeah, all kinds of things in that guy. So
there's a great work called Diagnosing Jefferson by Norm Legend that suggests that Jefferson had Asperger's.
Yeah.
He was an Aspie.
I find that fascinating in the story of in David McCulloch's book about Jefferson that. You know, when the British were coming to get him, and they're going to hang him from the nearest tree after the Declaration of Independence, they're essentially coming up the driveway to his house, and he was still fretting with his art objects and his paintings and stuffing stuff in the backpack before he jumped on his horse and went off, you know, out the back way,
mm-hmm.
barely escaped. And you see a man who was something of a ditherer, you know, and an introvert and. As you say, you know, Norm's book talked about, you know, wearing his bedroom slippers, doing presidential addresses, had the sensory integration problems.
Well, he was so shy that he wouldn't give the annual address to the nation that was required by the Constitution. He submitted it in writing.
Yes. That is so typical of the kids that I work with. And imagine if there had been standardized tests, you know, and
Jefferson would have been toast.
He would.
So would Washington, for that matter, because he didn't have the intellectual genius. He had a different kind of genius. I mean, James Madison was ghost wrote all of Washington's speeches.
Yes.
And Madison, you know, Madison, you read Madison's writings, he turns everything into it's either A or B. Total black and white. I mean, literally, you go through and read, you know, the Federalist Papers and things. Madison, you look at this problem, and you can divide it into this category or that category, A or B. And under A, there is C or D. And under C, there is E or F. And he always broke everything down into dualities. It wasn't any possibility in Madison's mind that there could be three things. And, you know, which leads one to suspect, you know, was Madison OCD?
Yes, OCD or, you know, some other... atypical, you know, brain chemistry that required him to have things like that in order, you know, the engineering mind.
Yeah, exactly.
And you think, again, if you were in the public school system, well, this boy is awfully oppositional, he can't play the game, you know.
These guys would be toast. So we have a minute and a half or two so to go here, George Lynn. We're speaking with George Lynn. He's the author of Genius, a new book, Genius, Nurturing the Spirit of the Wild, Odd, and Oppositional Child. George, what can parents do? What should parents do if they have children who are wild, odd, or oppositional?
Okay, well, you know, the conventional things, I think, apply, Tom. To some extent, you know, they need to be looking at what a kid's, you know, problems are in school, and they get a good educational assessment for that. But this isn't that the kid is broken again. This is just to identify, okay, you know, in the school environment, here are some things we need to compensate for. I'm not bad-mouthing medication. In the book, I call medication the scaffolding of, you know, growth of the personality. So at different times, medication is probably going to be an important thing for kids, but not necessarily all his life, not necessarily, you know, bonk a kid with it the first time you see some problem. So that's another part of it. The most, I think, an extremely important part, and what I try to do in my practice here, is learn to see the whole child. Don't break him down into little pieces, little symptoms, but try to just listen to him, understand that the most disturbing behavior he has is probably the seeds of what he's going to be successful with later on in his life. So it's really important to listen to a kid, to identify his particular genius, his particular quirk, you know, that you can kind of ride and smooth out and get him to adulthood. And it's also important to give him strategies. And in the book, I try to be practical with people. All my books, I try to just live up to this dictum of, you know, try to be useful, George.
George, nope. Very quickly, yeah. Janet in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania just is calling in. How do you, in 10 seconds, how do you know a kid is truly genius?
How do you know if a child is truly a genius?
Yeah.
I think I would agree with Einstein's quote, Tom, that all kids are geniuses.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah.
George Lynn, a licensed mental health counselor from Bellevue, Washington, who's pioneered the use of psychotherapy for adults and children. His new book, Genius, Nurturing the Spirit of the Wild, Odd, and Oppositional Child. Thanks, George. Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
See how they explain the inexplicable. Watch them all debate the undebatable. Apparently a lie is never liable. High time for a talk show.
Yes, welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 21 minutes past the hour. We're also streaming on AirAmericaRadio.com, WhiteRoseSociety.org. RadioPower.org, CRN Digital. You can tune us in on Sirius Satellite Radio. And, of course, on high-quality radio stations, literally from coast to coast. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-440-8466. Sometimes these old numbers just stick in your head, right? 866-440-8466, our telephone number, 440-THOM. Stuart in Seattle, Washington, on the line. Hey, Stuart, welcome to the program.
Yes, Tom, you say that you don't support consumer boycotts.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
I do support consumer boycotts.
Well, then it sounds like you don't support voting with your dollars.
No, I don't support that.
You don't support voting with your dollars. you know, that's exactly what these Great Boycott was. That's exactly what the
boycott
of South Africa was. It was voting with our dollars.
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
Okay, let's define terms here, Stuart.
Is it not vote? I'm sorry.
Here's my objection to the phrase voting with your dollars.
Yes.
If you and I buy into the conservative meme thought virus of voting with your dollars, then that means that those people with the most dollars get the most votes, and that's not democracy.
They already do.
They don't. We live in, at the level of our republic, it is one man, one person, one vote. And
that's a myth, one person, one vote in terms of how much power we have. Those corporations, did you cut me off?
No, I didn't.
Okay, it sounded like Vermont, but it's so common in this business. I broke my train of thought there, but
then let me make my point, Stuart.
$1. It's $1, one vote in how the legislators are chosen in the first place.
I don't disagree with you that we have a broken electoral system. Our broken electoral system is something that we need to address. States like Maine and Arizona have done some brilliant stuff with regard to that. Vermont is making some changes on it right now that are great. I mean, there's so much we need to do. That's a completely separate issue from consumer boycotts. I support consumer boycotts entirely, but I support them as guerrilla theater, not as voting with my dollars. Once we buy into the idea that we are voting with our dollars, we buy into the idea that it is appropriate that the people with the most dollars have the most votes. You and I know that there is a certain amount of reality to that, but I don't want to give it legitimacy. And so I say that, you know, for example, I was a big supporter of the Great Boycott. In fact, you know, I was out there with signs in front of supermarkets back, 20 years ago, and with the Great Boycotts. But there was, you know, no doubt in my mind that this really, the boycott itself, the economic impact of the boycott was not what caused the grape growers to negotiate with Cesar Chavez. What caused them to negotiate with Cesar Chavez was the political theater of it, the guerrilla theater of it. And that's where I think consumer boycotts, if they're done as theater, will work. You get a bunch of people out, you know, picketing in front of a store that you think is engaging in unfair practice, things like that. You do theater around this stuff, it'll work. If you simply try to shame people into not buying a particular product or not going to a particular store, and they do it relatively invisibly, it's never going to work. It'll make no difference.
It certainly is harder to see. It gives you more oomph if you have the theater, no doubt. But what I'm hearing from you is that if you found a better price on the same quality product at Walmart, you would buy it.
No, that's not what you're hearing from me.
Then what?
The point I made last week on this program.
Why is that not voting with your dollar?
It is making a statement of preference.
It's not just a statement.
I'm sorry. A store is not the ballot box, capitalism and free enterprise are not democracy. They are two separate things. We have an economic system in this country, and we have a political system in this country. And that's why I don't like using the word vote, which is from our political system, to describe our participation in our economic system.
Okay. Well,
here's where I said I wouldn't condemn somebody with regard to Walmart.
Yes.
For example, when I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, I lived in a little town in Vermont. I lived in Northfield, Vermont for 6 years and lived in Montpelier
lived
for
in
5 years. Okay. All right. So here we are. Louise and I wanted to buy some new bedding for the bed. I couldn't find a store within 100 miles other than a Walmart that carried new pillows.
What am I
supposed to do?
Well, in that case, you buy it from Walmart because the cost of your.
So you and I are saying the same thing. I'm saying, you know, or you go online, you know, and then you buy it from Amazon.com, which turns out is supporting George Bush's election campaign. I mean, it's like, what are you going to do?
It's making consumer choices is weighing things out. I live one block away from a Safeway, and I'd rather give my money to the local co-op.
I agree. I do the same thing.
It saves me so much time that I say, okay, I'm doing it because it saves me time to do more of the work that I want to do, and I'll still go to the co-op sometimes. I'll still support the small
business. I don't do that. I mean, I'll spend my time to go to the co-op instead of the big chain store, frankly.
But you won't spend the time to go 100 miles to get the thing that you needed that was available.
Walmart. That's right. We all have to define what the limits of our time are. Yeah,
it's
sure. Yeah, Stuart, I think we've kind of played this one out, but your point is well taken, and I appreciate it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And we will be back with more phone calls, more conversation. I want to get into this whole thing of left and right, left versus right in the United States. Is there a left in the United States? Do we represent the left in the United States? Am I the left in the United States? Who is the left? Where did they go? What happened? And what about the right? And the right? 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Hey, getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy as you
and welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live the day after Christmas, the second day of Hanukkah, the first day of Kwanzaa. Welcome back. 34 minutes past here. Coming up 25 minutes before the hour. See, I wonder if that, glass full, half full, glass half empty. I can't, we got to get your mic wired here, David, so we can get your opinions on this. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Is it 35 minutes past the hour or 25 minutes before? It's both. Bill in Bellingham, Washington on the line. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
What's up, Bill?
I really love your show. I'm a faithful follower, and I'm a liberal.
Okay.
And I just called up to tell you, there's some of us liberals still out there, and as far as I'm concerned, liberals are people who care about our country and care about the people.
Well, George Washington described himself as a liberal. This nation, in fact, during its first 50, 60 years, was described by its founders and by its senior statesmen as a liberal nation. It came out of the liberal enlightenment. George Washington said, I hope I shall ever see, if I'm doing this from memory, but I'm pretty sure it's accurate, I hope I shall ever see America at the forefront of liberality. So, yeah. So here we are. We're liberals. And of course, Jesus was the original liberal, given, this the spirit of the season here right now. Care for the poor, feed the hungry, visit those
correct.
In prison. Yeah. So, a point to make, Bill?
I just called up to show you some support, and I wanted to say that, I don't like supporting the big corporations because they haven't been taking care of the people, but sometimes I have to shop at Walmart.
Yeah. Well, that's my point. I mean, I'm not going to blame you for that.
When the top 20% income in the country is doubled in the last 25 years and everybody else is still making the same amount.
Yeah. No, making less.
Sometimes you ain't got money.
We have seen that the GAO just issued this report just about a month ago. The top 1% of wage earners in the United States have seen a substantial increase since George W. Bush came into office, and the bottom 95% have seen a steady erosion. And it's just that simple. Bill, thanks a lot for the call and for the point that you make. I mean, a lot of – and then the cons come along with this argument, and this is the one that you most commonly gets thrown back in your face, is – oh, you must really hate the working poor in America and people in the middle class scraping to get by if you want to say that we should have tariffs so that Walmart has to buy stuff made in America because the price of everything in Walmart will go up 10, 20, 30%. And I say, yeah, it will. But your paycheck will go up 100%. I mean, right now we've got $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year jobs, manufacturing jobs vanishing and being replaced by $12,000 a year Walmart jobs. And I think there's a whole lot of people in America who would be very happy to see their paycheck double and then pay an extra 20% at Walmart. In fact, they would be dancing in the streets. So this whole thing of, oh, well, you don't want to be opposed to these. And it's not, and by the way, it's not just Walmart. I am not trying to pick on Walmart. Because Walmart is operating within the law. This is not, I mean, there are times when Walmart breaks the law and they correctly need to be brought to heel for that. But that's a whole other topic. But, whether it's Walmart or, Bed Bath & Beyond or McDonald's or, pick your chain. I remember back in the 1960s, I hitchhiked across the United States, and every little town that I went through, and there was a whole mess of them, looked different. All locally owned businesses, locally owned restaurants, locally, every town had its own unique character. Now, you go through every town and here's a Walmart, there's a Burger King, there's a Chili's, and you can't tell what city you're in, you can't tell what state you're in. I travel around the world, sometimes you can't tell what country you're in. And, you know, at the aesthetic level, you can say, well, you know, it's a terrible thing aesthetically, the whole world has become homogenized, but my complaint is not the aesthetics of it. My complaint is that what that means is that it is now almost impossible for local entrepreneurs, local business people, local wannabe capitalists to start local businesses that can succeed in a local economy. It's almost impossible. And it's because we have stopped. It's because during the Reagan era, Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, the law that protected capitalism against itself. And a series of other laws that were passed since the 1930s by the Roosevelt and other administrations that basically protected small business people from the giant, you know, big monolithic business, huge business interests. As Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, said, the small businessman and the medium-sized businessman are the backbone of America. The big businessman I have a problem with. And this has got nothing to do with, you know, Marxism or anything like that. The reality is that in an absolutely unrestrained, pure free market enterprise environment, you are going to end up with one or two companies owning every industry, or maybe five or six who work cooperatively. You know, kind of wink, wink, nod, nod. Yeah, we'll raise our price 10%. Oh, gee, everybody just raised their price 10%. What a coincidence. Because there's only five or six companies. How many oil companies do we have who own most of our oil? Five or six. How many media companies do we have? Five or six. You know, there's 11,000 magazines in the United States owned by four corporations. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And this is all courtesy of Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, of this new economic vision that if we just turn things over to the big corporations, everything will be cool and the prosperity will trickle down. And I'm sorry, what has trickled down is poverty. Prosperity has certainly trickled up. John in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, thanks for calling.
Just so you know, I'm no longer on the air with you, so if you could leave me on during the entire response so I can hear it.
Sure.
I'd like you to play devil's advocate with me and literally and take everything that we talk about here can, and Molly Ivins has pointed this out 100%, all these issues can be, are all superseded by one, and that is campaign finance reform, election reform, and we've all heard the story, and I think the Green Party has by far the most citizen active system on their platform.
Hang on just a second, John. I agree with you on all that, except that even campaign finance reform is subsumed by the notion of corporate personhood, the idea that corporations have the same rights as human beings. And that sick and twisted notion, which has worked its way into law in the United States since 1886, which the founders absolutely not only would never have recognized but were openly opposed to, that is what, you know, in for example, Boston versus Bilotti, the Supreme Court case in 1978, and other cases like that, that is what has caused corporations to get their fingers back into our politics when it used to be a felony for corporations to participate in politics.
Now, here's the thing, though.
That's why McCain-Feingold, by the way, pardon my interrupting you again, John, but that's why McCain-Feingold doesn't regulate corporations, because they're persons like you and me, and they have rights. It has to regulate politicians. It's bizarre. Yeah. So anyway.
But to the man on the street, you ask him, what's the worst thing about politics? They'll say, oh, it's corruption, it's money, you know, we don't have a say. To the man on the street, there would be an overwhelming support to say, would you like Corporation A, Y, X, Z, whoever, to have the same say as you and no more? I know maybe it sounds naive. What is the argument against, like maybe you've heard it, I know you don't agree with it, maybe you've heard it, what is the argument against some type of campaign finance reform where me, you, and our listeners here have the same say and the same pull as Walmart or MBNA? What is the argument that says, oh, that's a bad idea and this is why? What is that argument? Because I don't think anybody would buy it if given the choice to hear both of them and act on it.
It started in 1886 when in the Supreme Court case, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, the clerk of the court inserted a footnote, or a headnote, actually, it's called, on the case, which contradicted the case itself, by the way, which said, under the 14th Amendment, which is passed to free the slaves, right, during Reconstruction in the 1870s, the 14th Amendment says, no person shall be denied equal equal protection under the law. Okay, and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments passed to free the slaves, and the 14th Amendment's called the Equal Protection, clause. Right, and it doesn't say now for hundreds of years in British common law and American common law, persons have been defined into two categories: artificial persons, which is corporations, churches, unions, and governments, and natural persons, which is human beings. And they both have some sort of person status because a corporation has to be able to pay taxes and has to be able to, be sued and sue and that kind of stuff. Now, the 14th Amendment doesn't say no natural person shall be denied equal protection under the law. So in 1886, the court, according to its clerk, ruled that corporations had the same rights as persons. Oddly, the court ruled that women didn't. That women didn't have that right. They didn't get that right until Roe v. Wade, actually, when the Fourth Amendment was acknowledged as having women. African Americans didn't have that right. They didn't get that until 1954, Brown versus Board of Education. But the corporations did. And then you fast forward back to up to 1978, and this case came before the United States Supreme Court, where the First National Bank of Boston was claiming the right to spend as much money as they wanted in a political campaign in Massachusetts, which was against the law in Massachusetts, saying, we have the right under the 14th Amendment not to be discriminated against. We have the First Amendment right of free speech. And since we don't have a mouth, we're a corporation, speech is money. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, ruled in favor of the corporation. And the lead dissent in that case was Rehnquist, the conservative. And in his dissent, Rehnquist opens the dissent by saying, in 1886, this court, without benefit of public discussion or open debate, ruled that corporations should have the same rights as persons, and I think that's wrong. Now I'm paraphrasing. And Rehnquist he hadn't bothered to read the 1886 case because it didn't actually say that. But anyhow, that's the argument that the corporations are putting forward. And right now, the Federalist Society and other right-wing groups, corporatist groups, and chambers of commerce around the United States are running workshops for corporate lawyers on how to use that corporate personhood to gain more and more political power. That's
so
the argument, John.
To deny corporations the right to donate millions of dollars and dwarf whatever say you or me may have.
They say it's illegal discrimination. They say it's illegal. They say it's the same as saying to a black person, you can't eat in this restaurant, it's for whites only.
Yeah, I'd like to see in a referendum how many citizens would actually say that that's a good argument, because they say it's a
It would never happen.
Bunch.
It would absolutely, but this is what's going on at law, and it's a subtle enough thing that most people don't understand it. And this is one of the major issues of the Federalist Society. This is what John Roberts is all about, by the way. John Roberts, big advocate of corporate personhood. Sam Alito, big advocate of corporate personhood. These guys are the absolute corporatists, and you'll recall back in the 1920s there was a politician in Europe who came up with the idea, what if we merged corporate power and state power? Wouldn't that make a stable government? And his name was Benito Mussolini. And that merger of corporate and state power, he named fascism, brand new form of government. John, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank
I appreciate
you,
it. It's I hope we haven't gotten too didydactic here, but that's really it. That's the bottom line, is saying, corporations should have these rights. And I'm sorry, corporations should not have rights. They're artificial entities. They may own property, but they're abstractions. A corporation's a piece of paper. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 46 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I've been meek and high like an oak. I've seen pretty people disappear like smoke. Friends will arise, friends will disappear. If you want me, honey, baby, I'll be here.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, or at least, a clean vote. We'd settle for a real election. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. I mentioned at the bottom of the hour, where is the left? What is the left? And that was a segue into a whole thing. I wanted to start out by talking about something that Fidel Castro is doing, actually. And perhaps we'll have time to get into it in the next hour in some more detail. But just the short version of it is, it just makes me crazy. I also do a local radio program before this national program here in Portland, Oregon, on KPOJ, 25,000-watt clear channel station here in Portland. And they have these liners, these intros that go, He's definitely liberal. Here's Tom Hartman. Or from the left, here's Tom. And I want to say, the left is dead in America. I'm sorry. The Communist Party of the United States. I had a guest on from the Communist Party, the CPUSA, 2 months ago or so, just to show you that these guys are cartoon characters. They're toast. They got, Joe McCarthy ate them alive. The Communist Party imploded. The Soviet Union collapsed. Communist China is simply a dictatorship. It's got nothing to do with, very little to do with communism. And there is no left in the United States anymore for all practical purposes. What there is this vast middle. I call it the radical middle. There's this vast middle who believes in things like, a fair wage for a fair day's work and a decent retirement. If you pay your dues and work, put in your hours every day and you do it for 30, 40 years, 20 years, whatever, decent retirement, being able to put your kids through school, free public education all the way up through college so that people from any class can move, who can have social mobility. Ability, they can move into the next economic class, health care for all, that health care should be a right for all citizens. These are things that more than 70, 80, 90% of Americans all agree on. We want a clean environment. We want a safe workplace, workplace safety standards. Just very simple, straight, but we want big corporations regulated in such a way that they don't make it impossible for the little guy to get started. That's not the left. That's the middle in America. And then you have the right. And that's the Bush administration. Oh, that Social Security stuff, that's communism. Let's privatize it. That Medicare, that's communism. Let's put a poison pill in it and say that it's going to cost so much. We're going to have to walk away from it by making it so that they can't negotiate with drug companies. All this kind of stuff. That's, in my mind, where we're going with that. Ben in Elgin, Illinois on the line. Hey, Ben, welcome to the program.
Hey there, Tom.
Is that Ben Birch?
Yep.
Hey, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. You are great, Ben. Thanks so much for streaming our program on your website.
You're very welcome, sir.
And archiving it.
And lots and lots of other liberal content.
That's right. A whole bunch of good progressive programs there.
I thought a lot about where the left is. And like you say, they become cartoon characters. The socialists, their tiny group, the communists, the wobblies even still exist.
Yeah.
I'm in contact with some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're...
And God bless them. They're fighting a good fight, but...
Every so often,
the Wobblies. The Wobblies, by the way, is the old IWW, which was one of the very first labor unions movements. Joe Hill was associated with them before he was put up in front of a firing squad in Salt Lake City in 1915, and they embraced the Communist Party. They were fellow travelers, shall we say?
Yes, and but they still exist. Every so often, they actually manage to organize a workplace.
Mm-hmm.
The thing to say is that despite the fact that the left is essentially gone, they get no media, even though, they are in fair numbers. I'd say they're probably 20,000 wobblies, The problem is that the left is still being used as a bludgeon against those of us who are actually centrist Americans who are fighting for the rights that all Americans ought to have.
Exactly. This is the thing that makes me crazy, Ben, is when I watch one of these talking head shows, Chris Matthews or something like this, and he goes, and now we've got the ultra-left Senator Russ Feingold. What's ultra-left about him? The fact that, this guy represents the mainstream values of America.
We haven't had an ultra-left senator in the latter half of the 20th century.
No, we haven't. We haven't had an ultra-left senator since the 1920s, and I forget his name, but there was the one guy who ultimately got vilified as being a communist.
Yep.
It's literally been that long.
The point is that by painting us as left and by painting as centrist what would have been the far right wing, they mask the fact that they are true fascists.
Or if you want to defuse the word, if you want to take the word fascist out, just because a lot of people misunderstand and think that means Nazi, just that they are true right-wing extremists.
Exactly.
And, yeah. Well said, Ben. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for keeping us up there on WhiteRoseSociety.org, a great website. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. In the Darwinian world of ideas, we're at the top of the food chain. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Telling you how it is. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman here. Welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. We'll be taking your phone calls in just a few minutes. First, we want to talk with Gerald Celente. He is with TrendsResearch.com, the guy who accurately predicted the stock market crash of 87, the boom in gourmet coffees, the breakup of the USSR, and a whole long pile of other things. He publishes the author of the best-selling book, Trends 2000, and you publish a newsletter. What's the name of the newsletter, Gerald?
The Trends Journal.
The Trends Journal. Thank you. That's the one piece that's missing here from your bio right here in front of me. It is great. It's great speaking with you.
Well, thank you for having me.
You say there is a Category 5 economy coming. Now, I assume by Category 5 you're talking about hurricanes?
Well, I'm talking about the intensity, of course, yeah. America's not prepared for what's going on. You know, current events form future trends. Let's just go back 2 months ago and remember all the hype coming out about what a great Christmas season this was going to be.
Right.
And all that coverage by the media of the people, you know, crashing down Walmart doors to get their $29.95 DVDs.
Right.
And it's not coming out like that. It'll be an okay year, but overall we're going to continue to see a decline, not only in retail sales, but a continuing decline in Americans' median income, which, by the way, according to the Bureau of Census, is at 1999 levels. I remember when I was a kid in school, in college, reading about the Depression. These are the kind of numbers that you read about back then. And it doesn't seem to be making any of the media. Instead, what they do is they keep looking at GDP growth, which is, you know, it's moderately good, but the financial cream is all going to the top. Yeah. And the gap between the rich and the poor, as you well know, is the widest in the United States than in any of the industrialized nations.
And it's the widest in the United States since 1929.
Excuse me?
And it's the widest in the United States since 1929.
Yeah, and also the debt levels, corporate, personal, and government, are at depression-level imbalances.
So are you anticipating something like the Great Depression happening?
Well, it's not like that in the sense that what's different now is the global marketplace. And this is part of that new paradigm. You know, America has to understand, which is very difficult because people get caught up in the ideologies and they like to keep yelling out, we're number one. There are only 300 million people in a sea of 6.3 billion, and they're not number one. They're not number one according to Lifestyle, according to The Economist, again, hardly a left-wing magazine. We fall behind in all international standards relative to education, health care, and just down the list. We're working 9 full work weeks longer than the Europeans. So America is going to go into a very tough time, and here's what to look for. I've been in this business over 25 years, and I began my career in Washington back in the 70s, and I started following the gold market. Jimmy Carter had come back from Iran and announced to the American people that the Shah was the island of stability in the Middle East, and that's when I became a political atheist. And then I said, what are the implications? And I started watching gold and oil.
Yeah.
Well, back in those days, when my first buy of gold was at $187.50 an ounce, and not to sound brilliant, I also bought it at the highest intraday trading in history at $875.
Yeah, I bought some when it was around
$600. So I followed this throughout. The point that I'm making is back then, it was only the United States, Europeans, and Japan trading in the gold market.
Mm-hmm.
Now you just threw in China, India, and Russia. You know, another 2.5 billion people.
Plus the Middle Eastern nations.
And plus the Middle Eastern nations. They were also dabbling back then, too. But the Chinese and Indians are real big buyers, and so are the Russians. Matter of fact, the Russians are now increasing their gold reserves. The point that I'm making is follow gold.
Yeah.
Gold prices are going up. It has no heart, no emotions, no feeling. Gold is betting against the dollar.
Well, to what extent could we say that, in fact, if you were to say how many ounces of gold equals how many loaves of bread from the year 1776 to today, it's always pretty much been the same number of loaves of bread equals the same amount of gold. And so really what's happening is not that the price of gold is going up, but that the real value of the dollar is going down.
Precisely. And because the United States has to borrow an estimated between $3 and $4 billion a day in foreign money to keep our deficit going, our current account deficit. So in order for that to happen, they have to keep interest rates high, because low interest rates is a cheap dollar, high interest rates, more expensive dollar. And foreign lenders don't want to get paid back in cheaper dollars than they loaned out.
But it's happening.
But it's happening.
I mean, this is the thing. Gerald Celente with TrendsResearch.com, when the Great Depression happened, basically the U.S. and Germany went in two different directions. We chose not to inflate our currency. In fact, I think probably in part because we were on the gold standard. In fact, Roosevelt made it illegal to own gold. On the other hand, the Germans decided to just run the printing presses. Now we hear that the Bush administration has just stopped publishing M3, which is the magic number that tells you whether or not the government is running the printing presses.
Right.
Isn't this a very scary sign?
Yes, it is. And that's why we're saying we're looking for a Category 3 hurricane. We're also saying that gold prices, and you look at our trend forecasts over the years, we've been picking the gold numbers nearly perfectly.
Yeah. So what do you think it's going to?
This year's one of our top trends was golden bull. We said this was the year it was going to take off.
Yeah.
So what we're saying is watch gold. It could go into the $2,000 to $3,000 range virtually overnight. And the United States economy is in for rough sledding. It does not mean that the rest of the world is going to go into a depression. A whole new world order really is taking place.
Yeah, it's shifting over to India and China right now.
Yes, and you're also seeing a lot of basic and fundamental changes happening in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And those governments are readjusting and getting away from the dictatorial governments that ruled it for so long into more democratic and trading partner type of arrangements.
Right.
So that's what we're looking for in the economy.
Okay, that's interesting with regard to the economy. We have about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes left here. We're talking with Gerald Celente. He is the founder of the Trends Research Institute, trendsresearch.com, the website. One of the notes that you make here is profiting from the 2006 alternative energy explosion. What are the opportunities for investors beyond gold?
Well, there's a magazine that we recommend. It's called Infinite Energy. It's infinite-energy.com is their website. And they're really looking at some real breakthrough things beyond, you know, solar and wind, as such things as hydrino power, coal fusion, zero point energy, charge clusters. And what's going on is when we believe that the magic point for alternative energy is gasoline at $4 a gallon. And by the way, we're looking now for gas, we're watching gasoline prices and fuel prices very closely after the holiday. We're betting that they're going to go up.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. I just came back from Germany. I was there 2 weekends ago. And as you take the train, I took the train for about 6 hours going east to west across the country. So I was looking on the right side of the train. I was looking at the south the roofs of all these houses, and they're all covered with solar collectors. The German government has a program now where they will loan you at about 2% the money to put solar collectors on your house. They require the utilities to buy the electricity back from you at 8 times the rate that it's sold at. And so in effect, you can generate electricity, sell it to the power company, which is enough money to pay off the loan over a 10-year period. At the end of 10 years, during that 10 years, you're at zero. You're breaking even. At the end of 10 years, you're able to produce your own electricity.
Well, the difference is that those countries are social democracies, and we're not. You know, we're corporate republics.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not what they do here. Dogs don't make cats. And that's the desire of the American people, not to have a social democracy.
Well, some of the American people.
Well, the majority.
I would disagree with you on that, Gerald.
Well, I only go by the votes and how people react. For instance, with the Iraq war, you still see a majority of the people supporting it. So they'd rather spend their money on that than on other things.
Yeah, well, again, I think that what we're seeing is the result of some very, very good spin and propaganda more than
we just look at
If you're just looking at the outcome, you know, I don't disagree with you.
Right.
So
that's what we're looking at. And there's something else, so just really quickly, a real phenomenon, mm-hmm. and that is the sentimental journey. For the first time in modern American history, the current generation is looking to the past to find its future. From Lenin to Dylan to Kennedy to King, they have no heroes now. They're looking back to find them.
Fascinating. It's funny. I play audio clips of FDR and JFK on this show, and I get so much email whenever I do. I mean, people call up in tears. It's amazing. 16 minutes past the hour, trendsresearch.com, the website. Gerald Celente. Thank you, Gerald, for being with us. Great speaking with you. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
So a new man in the White House with a familiar name said he had some fresh ideas, but Twitch now says he came from Texas to Washington.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, Tom Hartman radio program. As longtime listeners of the program know, every year I send $5 to the Republican National Committee and various Republican candidates. You know, I figure, you know, $5 is enough that it'll probably cost them that much to process it, and it gets me on their list. So just got an email here from Tom Reynolds, the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, saying, during the last weeks of this year, please remember all of those who are less fortunate than you and those who are away from their families this season. Isn't that sweet? This was 2 days after the Republican majority in the Senate and the Republican majority in the House slashed $12.7 billion from higher education, reducing federal subsidies for lending. So on average, students, middle-class and working-class students who have to borrow in order to go to college will have to pay $5,800 more over the life of their loan because of higher interest rates, corporations making more profit on student loans. That they slashed $6.4 billion out of Medicare, freezing doctors' payments under Medicare, as well as payments to home health care providers, cutting payments for imaging services. In other words, granny has a tumor, she'll never find out what it is. Slashed $4.7 billion from Medicaid co-payments. This is from USA Today. Co-payments for low-income recipients could soar from $3 now to $100 or more. In other words, granny won't be able to pay for her medicine anymore. It'll force, William Novelli, the president of AARP, says, force some Americans to forfeit their homes in order to pay for long-term care services. Over $1 billion slashed from welfare programs, the social safety net. You want people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Some folks don't have bootstraps to begin with. Give them some bootstraps, very often, more often than not, frankly, they will move out of poverty given the opportunity. But the increase in child care subsidies now, this is for, by and large, for working poor, for parents of children who have to have child care in order to be able to work at their minimum wage job. The increase in child care subsidies is not enough to cover children whose parents will go to work. States will be left with unpalatable choices, says Mark Greenberg of the Center for Law and Social Policy. Cut child care for other low-income working families, cut other benefits or services, or cut assistance to needy families. And, of course, the Republicans just cut $1.5 billion over a five-year period from bonus money that is given to the states right now to encourage the states to track down and bring to justice deadbeat, by and large, dads. There's a few moms out there, but mostly deadbeat dads with regard to child support payments. This $1.5 billion in federal bonuses has caused the states to be able to increase collections by $2.9 billion. So this isn't even an expense. This is an investment. As Vicky Turetsky of the Center for Law and Social Policy says, the child support program has made dramatic progress. This will put the program in reverse. But, you know, we get I get the nice email from Tom Reynolds. Dear supporter, wanted to take a moment to wish you and your family a Merry Christmas and a happy holiday season. And during the last weeks of this year, please remember all of those who are less fortunate than you. May God bless America. Sincerely, Tom Reynolds from the National Republican Congressional Committee. Yeah. somehow I am not impressed. I just have to say. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Mike in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Mike. Great. I hope you had a nice Christmas, Hanukkah, whatever it might have been for you yesterday.
Christmas was busy.
Yeah, it was for us, too. It was really nice, though. We had a lot of our family here, and it was just marvelous. So, anyhow, what's up?
Just wanted to comment on your what is left and what is right comments earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, I consider myself moderate, kind of leans left, especially with George in the Oval Office. I'm really left. But if you were to say what's ultra-left, I would think, like, Michael Moore. But if you would say what's ultra-right, you would think George Bush.
Yeah, well, see, here's the thing. Even Michael Moore is not ultra-left because the communists believed that the state should control the means of production and supply. In other words, all businesses should be owned by the state.
Yeah.
That is ultra-left. Michael Moore would never go for that.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure if I'm half glass full or empty on this, but sometimes I think to myself, I don't know if my facts are right, I doubt they are, but I think a Republican politician would give the corporation, like the oil corporation, says, hey, thanks for the campaign money, here's your 100% tax break, but you know, along with all that money, hey, how about allowing some more mercury to go in the air because it costs money for you to keep the mercury down at a certain level.
Sure.
So
that's what's happening. What we're seeing happen. It's just very simple. I mean, you can track policy by just watching the campaign contributions to the Republicans. Mike, thanks for the call. Ashley in Albany, New York. Half a minute left here, Ashley. Something quick?
Hey, how you doing?
Just great. What's up?
I was wondering, you talked about the East India Corporation and Walmart a few years ago.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could explain that. Or.
Well, the East India Company was the biggest multinational corporation in the world in 1773, and the Boston Tea Party was an open revolt by small business people in Boston, although it was happening all up and down the East Coast. The big one was in Boston. The Boston Tea Party was an open revolt, a million-dollar act of vandalism, in fact, against the world's largest multinational corporation. It was, in essence, like the Seattle WTO protest. It was the first time that the citizens of America stood up to what was the world's largest multinational corporation and said, we don't want that here, and we're going to do something about it. And they did. It was pretty remarkable, actually. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't worry about a thing. Every little thing gonna be all right.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends.
Singing, don't worry.
I really do think everything's going to be all right. The reason why I believe that, even though this administration may be pursuing some of the policies that are echoes of what happened in Spain and Italy and Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, is that we're the ones who started this whole democracy thing over 200 years ago in the world, and it is burned into our DNA. We've had so many generations of it, even for recent immigrants to the United States, it is in the air. It's in our water. It's burned into us. And then you got great people out there like Doug Cunningham at LaborRadio.org, he's a reporter and anchor with the National Workers Independent News and produces the Daily Win News story on Air America Radio, and also carried for those listening to the web stream. We carry it on this program at the bottom of every single hour. Hey, Doug, welcome to the program.
Yeah, with me. Hope you're having a happy holiday.
Well, thank you. I am, and hope all is well with you and yours, Doug.
Yep, having a nice, fulfilling but quiet Christmas holiday. I like
that. Great, great. That's the best kind. Tell us what's the news for labor news right now.
Well, obviously we've had a big thing with the New York City transit strike, and that's still not over. I mean, the strike itself is, but the contract negotiation settlement still has to be resolved. And I think one of the biggest stories actually going into the new year, one of the biggest labor stories, will be the auto industry and the crisis that it's still facing with Delphi, the auto parts manufacturer, General Motors, Ford Motor Company, which just won health care concessions from its UAW members, And this whole Delphi bankruptcy that endangers GM and the whole concept of pensions and how they're under attack in this industry. And the auto industry in this country is still a very important industry. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be a big, huge story, I think, going into the new year as this Delphi thing shakes out and we see what General Motors is going to look like over the next couple of years.
I noticed one of the op-ed columnists in the Wall Street Journal on, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday of last week, had a piece in which he was essentially predicting that General Motors would be declaring bankruptcy in 2006. And that, in part, the purpose for that would be to shed themselves of their pension obligations. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, that's obviously a huge concern, and I'm very concerned about that. I know that a lot of business analysts are saying that General Motors, that the chances of General Motors filing bankruptcy are great. General Motors itself is saying no, they're not near that point. They still have about $19 billion in cash reserves to get through this thing, and they're going to have some plant closings that are going to go into effect, so that's going to help them save costs. They have a health care agreement with UAW that will help their bottom line a bit as well. I don't think that GM will be filing bankruptcy in the near future. I think it is a threat in the long term if they don't turn around their market share. And I have parents who are retirees of General Motors. They're UAW members in Michigan, and they're dependent on that pension, and as are many other workers. And that is a very, very serious concern, obviously, because that also was the issue in the New York City transit strike that triggered that. And this we've seen a pension assault. On worker pensions across the country, and bankruptcy is often used as a way for these businesses and corporations to divest themselves of that responsibility. And that's an immoral act by businesses like General Motors, which at this point, even though things aren't going well for them, they are not. They don't have to declare bankruptcy at this point, and they may not.
Although we've seen some airlines do this, we've seen other companies do this. I mean, the number of pensions that are being picked up by the Pension Guarantee Corporation. The federal agency is pretty startling, billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah, and speaking of airlines, obviously United Airlines that got rid of its pensions. And here's a little news item for your listeners who may or may not be aware of this. Even though they destroyed workers' pensions, got rid of those in bankruptcy, as they emerge from bankruptcy, executives at United will be splitting a minimum of $285 million in stock, which averages out to more than $700,000 per executive if they break it up evenly like that. And, of course, workers represented by the unions who saw their members' pensions be destroyed by this move are outraged at this, as well they should be. But that's the pattern in these bankruptcies. I mean, they come in, corporate raiders in some respects here tend to loot companies. And so even though the workers end up losing and sometimes stockholders end up losing, the executives end up winning in bankruptcies quite often.
We are, Doug Cunningham with LaborRadio.org, we are in a very real way, Doug, wouldn't you say, moving from a democracy, a constitutionally limited democratic republic to a new form of aristocracy where the new kings, a new form of feudalism even would be a better description, where the new nobles are the corporate CEOs. They literally live in a world separate from us. They're not the guys who are flying in first class on the airlines. Those are the road warriors. Those are the guys who just simply fly enough that they get enough frequent flyer miles, they can upgrade themselves. The CEO class and the senior executives in America live in gated communities. They travel by limousine. They travel by private jet. They have very little contact with the rest of us.
Yeah, and that's an extremely threatening thing for our democracy, because we're in what amounts to an oligarchy. And it's similar to actually the Gilded Age. This is sort of a 21st century Gilded Age. You know, the excesses that existed in the Roaring Twenties and also
right.
beyond that, back
which
the,
brought us the Great Depression.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's what people have to understand is it's bad for America. It's against our national interest. It's not in the interest of the United States to see the middle class weakened, to see working people harmed, to see working families put out of jobs and have their pensions destroyed, et cetera, even though some economists may point to the economy, quote-unquote, and say the economy is doing great, it's strong, profits are up, et cetera, things look rosy for Wall Street sometimes, you know, but that's not what is good for America. That's not what's
yeah.
in the best interest.
It just makes me crazy when I see these talking heads on TV saying, well, the stock market is up, the GDP went up, but the economy looks like it's doing pretty good, doesn't it, Ralph? You know, and you know that these guys are making, you know, $500,000, $500,000, $1 million a year, and of course it's fine for them, but the average working stiff in America pay is actually going down, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is, and if it's not going down for large segments of workers, it's certainly stagnating. And what people have to understand, and what we try to do at Workers Independent News, is we try to relate these things, these developments, and this news to how it impacts average working people in this country, what it really means for you. I mean, is it good for you when they outsource jobs? No. Is it good for you when pensions are destroyed? No. Is it good when wages don't increase? No. So, you know, all that adds up. That is the economy, quote-unquote.
And yet the Republicans continue to rationalize this. I mean, the Republican Party actually endorsed, the Bush administration actually has come out and overtly said outsourcing of jobs is good for the American economy. They come right out and say this stuff. It's not like they have no shame. It's like they believe in the tooth fairy or something. I mean, they believe in George Bush Sr. called it voodoo economics, and we're finding that it is.
Well, and they're absolutely shameless, Tom, at the same time, with attacking workers, with one hand saying, lying, essentially, that the economy is doing great, because it's not for most working families, and then on the other hand, attacking at every opportunity the working families in this country, whether it be, you know, in the Davis-Bacon Act in New Orleans rebuilding and having to backpedal on that under union pressure, or whether it's the government workers who they've taken collective bargaining rights away from and are still fighting with them over that, trying to take more rights away from them. Everywhere you turn, New York, you know, NYU grad students who are on strike because of a Bush NLRB decision that they no longer have to recognize their union at NYU. Every time that they have an opportunity to take away the rights of working families, they do it. And every time they have the chance to depress wages and enrich the corporate elite who run the country, they do that. And I know sometimes if we keep pounding this message, it sounds like we're being repetitive, but the truth is we're just being accurate, reporting what they are doing. And we're trying to put that and frame that debate with Workers Independent News by putting this out on a daily basis and trying to relate it to what...
And what boggles my mind, Doug Cunningham with laborradio.org, I grew up in Michigan. And
in fact my
dad ran a little tool and die shop, 12 guys, and you know, Oldsmobile was their biggest customer and all that kind of stuff. He didn't own it. But in any case, two of my three brothers are union. In fact, they're shop stewards. When you and I grew up, in Michigan, there was the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News. And one was the labor paper and the other was the business paper.
Right. Yep.
And one had a labor section, literally a labor section. The other had the business section. And, you know, now they kind of merged, and it was like that all over the country. I mean, newspapers actually had labor sections throughout the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And in the 80s, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and then in the 90s, when Clinton, you know, signed the Telecommunications Act, and the media mergers just went nuts, now we see nothing but news about business. There's not, other than laborradio.org, other than the Workers Independent News, I'm not seeing much news of labor out there anywhere.
Especially in broadcast. And we saw that with the New York City transit strike, how I think the national media hammered them in that strike, focusing entirely on the illegality of it and the inconvenience that it caused commuters, and not focusing on what triggered the strike in the first place, which was an attack on pensions. And, you know, you can't blame workers for defending their pensions. And if the MTA had not attacked pensions in the first place, they wouldn't have triggered that strike. So the blame for that falls on them. And besides, there's a question about the illegality there, even with the Taylor Law in New York State.
Sure.
Because you can't really deal with pension issues at the bargaining table. You have to go to the legislature in New York State for public employees for that.
Yeah, it looks like the MTA broke the law first, actually. But, and how is that, what's the latest with that strike? I know it's still...
Well, there's been something of a news blackout because they're trying to talk to each other and get contracts hammered out. I mean, they still have to hammer out all the details and get an actual contract signed, a new one.
Yeah.
And for the time being, pensions were off the table. That's what got the workers back to work, essentially. But that doesn't stay off the table forever. And I understand that they're talking about health care concessions now instead of pension concessions.
Oh,
so
geez.
We still have to wait and see how that's going to happen.
So, I mean, for 50 years in the United States, from the 1930s through the 1980s, the vast majority of labor actions were to get better pay, better vacations, better working hours, safer labor conditions, better benefits. Since then, it's been, please don't cut me 50%, only cut me 30% in my health care. I mean, we're doing a rear guard action here, Doug.
Yeah, we're playing defense when we got to go on the offense, and I hope that's what happens in the new year, that labor is able to go on the offense.
Well, from your lips to God's ears. We'll see how it plays out. Doug Cunningham, laborradio.org. Check it out. Thanks so much for being with us, Doug.
Thanks,
Happy
Tom.
New Year. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back with your calls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com. Get all the latest Macintosh electronics, all kinds of computer equipment. Check out Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MACS. Jack in North Bend, Oregon on the line. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
Morning to you, Tom.
Good morning, Jack.
Tom, I certainly want to wish you and yours the best new year ever coming up.
Well, thank you, and the same to you and your family, and all of us here in America. Not to sound too much like Tiny Tim, but we need all the help we can get, don't we?
We all need the best new year we've had, at least lately.
There you go.
Tom, you're very good at occasionally reading statements by other people, brief quotes, and I have three very brief ones here I'd like to read very quickly if I could.
Can't let you do that, Jack.
We just
have an absolute rule, you know, once it starts, it gets out of control. Don't let people read on the radio. But if you got something you want to say,
I'd be glad
to hear from you.
I do. And it's related to what I was going to read quote-wise. And in those quotes was John Kennedy and David Spangler of the Planetary Initiative, part of the United Nations.
Yeah.
Feel free to
email them to me, you know, or post them on our message board or something like that.
Another one was by David Rockefeller, and I don't have a computer, so I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, okay.
But at any rate, Tom, there are two very basic areas to the current events of today and the ones foreseen to be in our very near future as things go on the way they have been going, especially recently in the Bush administration. They're completely ignored, these two areas, for the most part. They are nuanced occasionally by you and your colleagues. The most main area, of course, would be the Luciferian doctrine. There is historical research that goes back centuries that well documents that the Luciferian doctrine is alive and well.
You're talking about Satanism?
Well, the Luciferian doctrine is believing that Lucifer is Almighty God, and that he's the architect of the universe and the bringer of all light, wisdom, and intelligence.
You know, I don't know anybody who subscribes to that, Jack. Do you?
Well, they don't make themselves well known, but if you ask, you may get some answers which would surprise you if you even suspect that someone...
I'll have to Google this when we get off the air. Okay,
yeah.
and the other, you said there was one. What's the other one?
Well, the other is the 9/11 issue, and there is a whole body of evidence there also, which is more recent historically documented, but it's been documented in various places by some people with very great expertise in the area of docu-journalism.
Oh, yeah. The questions around 9/11, Jack, literally never end. I mean, they just go on and on and on, and I am not a proponent of any particular conspiracy theory with regard to 9/11, I'm willing to believe that any of them are possible. The bottom line for me is we haven't seen a real investigation of this thing yet, and so I'm keeping an open mind. Thank you for calling, Jack. Xavier in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Xavier, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Yeah, just briefly, before I get to my comment, that last caller, I think it's Judaism. There's Christians have a tendency to lump a lot of deities together. There's like Lucifer actually means bearer of light.
Yeah, angel of light,
There's devil and Satan. They're all different entities, and they're not all necessarily evil. But I wanted to get to my point was I think like Adam Smith and Karl Marx both had some good ideas that got co-opted by human greed. And one of the things I say to right-wingers a lot of times is that under communism, the government takes over business, and under capitalism run amok, which is fascism, business takes over government, and the end result is essentially the same. We have a monopoly, and we have nowhere to turn.
And that's why neither of those two extremes, and what you just basically defined, is the government and the governmental and economic left extreme and right extreme, and that's why neither one of those two extremes are appropriate. Karl Marx, if you read Das Kapital, I think he correctly diagnosed some of the problems with unrestrained capitalism, but his prescription didn't work. I mean, I was in the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union. I was in East Germany when it was East Germany, and it didn't work. It was a mess. On the other hand, I've been on kibbutz, kibbutzim, in these, you know, collective farms in Israel that are run communistically, where it's fewer than 150 people, and they do work, and that's how most tribal communities are set up. So it works with small communities, but it doesn't work with big communities, and it's just a, you know, a very simple and an unfortunate reality. Marx was taking, you know, basically a tribal system that works well for tribes and trying to make it a universal system, and it got corrupted, and it doesn't work, and that's why I am not and never would be an advocate of communism for anything larger than a group of 150 people. And you want to try and do it in a commune, cool. You want to try and do it in a nation, it ain't going to work. I'm all in favor of constitutionally limited democratic republic, which is what our founders came up with. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We have 1 minute to go. Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Gary.
Thanks for taking my call. I just tuned in. The gall of the... I know we're supposed to present solutions to the Democratic Party and this and that. I'll leave it to better minds than me. But the gall of the Republican Party and those on the right to deny hard-working, honest Americans a minimum standard of living. Oh, sure, they're for a minimum wage. The lower, the better.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it is mind-boggling. Well, you know, actually, when Thomas Paine wrote The Rights of Man, and first proposed a minimum wage in the 1790s, he was arguing against the maximum wage laws that they had in England. They actually had laws in England that said that it was illegal to pay people more than what would at that time have been the equivalent today of about $6 an hour. In other words, they had laws that forced people to stay in the working poor. And I mean, essentially,
minimum standard of living.
Yeah, and the way that the Republicans do that, and this is what Alan Greenspan has already said his job is to make sure that, you know, whenever the economy gets a little heated up, he cranks up inflation rates to increase what he calls worker insecurity, so we won't have what he calls wage inflation, so that we can maintain that world that Dickens was talking about. Thanks for being with us today, my friends. We're here every day, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And we'll be back tomorrow. Remember, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.